Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for the April 20, 2022 reading of the Environment Program. I'm Karen Wheeler, and today we will be reading the following main articles. In South Africa, a seed librarian seeks ancestral knowledge. Written by Mary Fawzi for the Environment Desk at Atlas Obscura. Does climate change affect grizzly hibernation? Research indicates the answer is yes. Written by Lena Beck for the Vital Ground Foundation newsletter. And if we have time, following up with miscellaneous articles. First up, in South Africa, a seed librarian seeks ancestral knowledge. Zayan Khan runs a seed bibliothèque out of her home. Written by Mary Fawzi. Zayan Khan's work as a seed librarian and horticulturalist often seems fun and playful as she talks to insects, sticks her hands in the dirt, and puts strange plants in her mouth at her workshops. It's obvious that she finds joy in what she does. But much of her practice revolves around the confrontation of a traumatic past. In South Africa, colonization and genocide have erased millennia of local food knowledge, leaving the country with a food system at odds with what the land can actually provide. Through sharing seeds and teaching food preservation, Khan hopes to create a more equitable food system. The Greater Cape Town area, on the west coast of South Africa, is one of the most biodiverse places on Earth. The land is a unique multiverse of plants, animals, and insects, many of which exist nowhere else. But rapid urbanization and forced displacement over the last 50 years forced many people away from the land and towards corporate entities like supermarkets for accessing food. Quote, even if the supermarket is far away, Khan says. This is a big problem when 1 in 5 South Africans live in extreme poverty. The issue is the foundation of Khan's work. Khan, the daughter of a school librarian, has always sought knowledge. In 2003, she started studying journalism at university, but found the field was not stimulating enough. Instead, she plumbed her own background for inspiration. Khan is deeply tied to Cape Town, belonging to the Cape Malay, Cape Muslim community, a group that descends from people enslaved or brought as indentured laborers by the Dutch East India Company from other colonies. However, Khan finds the Cape May identity too limiting and prefers to use the term Cape Creole, which has a greater acknowledgement of indigenous heritage. In South Africa, terms of identity are fraught and complex, but Khan hopes to reconnect people to their roots, whether they identify as indigenous, black, Cape Creole, or Cape Malay. This is an especially powerful form of resistance, considering how a recent state audit showed that 72% of agricultural land in South Africa is owned by white people, a community that makes up less than 10% of the population. In 2005, Khan found her curiosity piqued by the ecological history of the Cape, and spent the next 5 years studying landscaping and horticulture at different universities in Cape Town. She came to understand that this huge disconnection and separateness between the food system and the land is due to centuries of loss through the destruction of foodways, people, animals, and land at the hands of European colonizers. For example, the Khoi peoples, some of the early inhabitants of the Cape, were decimated by both disease brought by the Dutch and by brutal violence. Along with the destruction, Europeans brought with them plants with which they were familiar and introduced numerous invasive species. Many of those plants, Kahn explains, are less drought-resistant and more prone to fire than indigenous plants. Fascinated by the horticultural history of the Cape around her, Kahn followed in her mother's footsteps and became a librarian herself, of a slightly different kind. In 2011, she opened the Seed Bibliothèque in her Cape Town home, offering seeds, art, recipes, and even jewelry made from seeds. Anyone is welcome to borrow from the library. To Kahn, the difference between a seed bank and a seed library is that libraries encourage the movement and use of seeds, as opposed to saving and storing them. The idea of a seed bank has a different connotation. It implies creditors, debtors, and the building of reserves. A seed library, she emphasizes, has no connotations of financial exchange. Instead, hers relies on a system of lending. If you were to borrow anything from 5 seeds to a kilogram of seeds, that's what would get in return the next season. Kahn's own garden is an otherworldly one, full of various plants that feed her, others, and the library. These plants, which include Strelitzia nicolai, or wild banana, and the medicinal but poisonous Boophany distica, whose bulb coverings, Kahn says, can be used as bandages. There are Cape aloe trees, whose flowers feed bees and other insects, and the indigenous Lablab purpureus, also known as simply Lablab, or hyacinth beans. The latter arrived a season after Kahn's initial attempt to grow them was hijacked by snails. Kahn shared with Instagram followers her process. "Waiting for recipes to rise up at me, I trawl cookbooks while the seeds harden. There will be enough for one meal for sure, with a few seeds left for the library." A few weeks later, Kahn cooked the beans into a delicious curry with sweet potatoes, kale tops, and coriander blossoms. Beyond making seeds available to her community, working in community garden spaces in government-neglected areas around Cape Town and holding workshops for children, Kahn also dove into researching other lost foodways. As so much of this history was shared orally through generations of indigenous people, knowledge became severed through ongoing cycles of violence. Often, she found herself looking through out-of-print cookbooks or exploration accounts, mostly written by Europeans. "There's so much information out there, even though they're so racist and difficult to read," she says. But she would come across things that people no longer ate, such as South African penguin eggs or flamingo eggs. Along with uncovering age-old food history, Kahn also researches and teaches preservation techniques, especially fermentation. Teaching how to transform food for preservation means that people can build a long-lasting pantry using indigenous plants that are readily available. It's here that Kahn waxes poetic. "There's a kind of slowing down of time through preservation. You are essentially making little time machines," she says. "You really didn't do much. You just packed the salt, put on the lid, and all this magic happens." But she also is open to combining ancient knowledge with current realities. when she had a surplus bounty of tomatoes, a non-indigenous food. She sought ways to preserve them. One night, she dreamt the answer, turning them into mibos. Mibos is an old Cape recipe for preserved apricots, but in this case, even tomatoes, sun-dried and packed with sugar and salt, can become a sweet, salty, sticky treat. To Khan, dreams are a powerful source of inspiration. Sometimes, she says, she'll come to answers to thorny culinary questions in her sleep. But one dream Khan would like to make reality would be to move her seed bibliothèque to a public space where she could provide formal training in seed knowledge. As one of the few people in South Africa to be doing this kind of work, and one of the few people of color in a whitewashed and often over-romanticized field, she feels an immense sense of responsibility. After all, refamiliarizing people with the ability to pursue food security and connection with their ancestors is an enormous and daunting task. These days, Khan is busier than ever. In 2021, she embarked on a PhD, and now she's pregnant with her second child. Even after all she's done, Khan sees her work with indigenous food as just the beginning, and she's very enthusiastic about the future. Does climate change affect grizzly hibernation? Research indicates the answer is yes. By Lena Beck. On Monday, March 7, Yellowstone National Park reported its first grizzly sighting of the year. After months spent hibernating through the winter, male grizzlies typically emerge from the den in early March. Females will follow with their cubs a short time later, often in late April or May. Hibernation isn't so much a months-long sleep as it is a state of deep torpor. This biological adaptation allows bears to wait out the cold winter months when there isn't enough food to sustain the species. During that time, the bears survive by relying on fat stores that they built up during the previous warm season, and when warmer temperatures arrive, the bears emerge. But as climate change increasingly affects seasonal temperatures, how will grizzly bears respond? There's a lot we don't know about this, but research indicates their hibernation cycles will be affected in some way. Research published in 2016 indicates that grizzly bear den exit is linked to weather. This means warmer temperatures brought about by climate change could result in bears leaving dens sooner. This could put them at risk of emerging before there is enough food. This issue has ramifications for both grizzlies and humans, in that it may drive grizzlies into human-populated areas in their search for something to eat. That would make spreading conflict prevention tools even more important to bear and human safety. In their press release announcing the emergence of the year's first grizzly bear, Yellowstone National Park urged human recreators to be extra careful at this time of year. The park even restricts visitor activity in certain grizzly-populated areas to reduce the risk of interaction while the bears search for deer and elk carcasses on which to feed. In Yellowstone National Park, those restrictions began on March 10. Spring visitors hiking, skiing, or snowshoeing in the park can reduce the chances of encountering bears by avoiding low-elevation winter ranges, thermal areas, and south-facing slopes where bears seek out ungulate carcasses and spring vegetation shortly after emerging from winter dens. Said Carrie Gunther, the park's bear management biologist, in the park's press release announcing this first sighting. Research published in 2019 studied the effects of climate change on the seasonal availability of the sambucus plant, a berry commonly used by people and a favorite of omnivorous grizzly bears. The study area in the Canadian Rocky Mountains encompassed the entire grizzly bear range in the Alberta province. Growth chamber simulations sought to understand how sambucus would be affected by warming. The results indicated that in future climates, the berries may ripen up to 3 weeks earlier than they do now. This could result in food resources for the grizzly becoming out of sync during those critical warm weather months when the grizzly bear is trying to build up fat storage. This, in turn, could affect the grizzly's ability to produce offspring while denning. Wayne Caswerm, a biologist for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Grizzly Bear Recovery Program, has been monitoring grizzly activity, including denning behavior, since the 1980s. Based in Libby, Montana, he's covered multiple service areas in the Mountain West. Anecdotally, he says, it does seem that grizzlies are emerging from hibernation sooner than they used to, but it's hard to say one way or another conclusively. I can't say this unequivocally, but it certainly appears over time that we're getting earlier den exit than maybe we have seen in the past, Caswerm said. If they do begin emerging earlier, Caswerm is not so much worried about the grizzlies not having enough to eat. If it's warm enough to wake them up, it may also be warm enough for the species that grizzlies eat. But he is concerned that early den departure may affect the health of grizzly cubs. I think the greater discussion point here is more related to reproduction, to cubs born in the den, Caswerm said. And when the female leaves the den, or if they need to leave the den earlier, what's the impact on the young? Grizzlies have a long gestation period, and then the first few months of the cub's life are spent in the den. The den environment essentially functions as an incubator during those months after a bear is born, Caswerm said. If that timing were to be cut short, Caswerm worries that we might see an increase in cub mortality. And yet, if that were to happen, it would be really hard to figure out exactly what was impacting the bear cubs, and even more difficult to put a finger on how to help them. In other words, we won't know the extent of the fallout of climate change for grizzly bears for quite some time. Besides hibernation, climate change also affects grizzly bear habitat. For example, the whitebark pine, a tree with seeds that are an important food source for grizzlies, is directly affected by warming temperatures. As omnivores who can survive in many habitats, grizzlies can adapt when things change, but those behavior shifts could lead to more run-ins between bears and people, especially as population growth and development continue to fragment and shrink wild areas in the northern Rockies. So, while there is still much we don't know about how climate change will affect grizzlies, we can help protect grizzlies from our shared environmental crisis by preserving the land they need to live on and helping bears and people coexist safely. From the Field Notes column of the Spring 2022 issue of Audubon Magazine, Enduring Mysteries by Jillian Mock. Migrating birds employ skills far beyond human abilities. They depart on time without the use of a calendar and navigate long distances sans smartphone. They fly for days with few, if any, pit stops. Scientists can explain a lot about these arduous journeys, but the quest to fully understand them continues. Question 1. How do birds prepare their bodies for flight? Migrating is a major physical challenge. To get ready for the trip, birds can make huge changes to their bodies in a matter of days. Birds rely on fat to fuel flight, in contrast to humans, who burn a lot of carbohydrates and sugars during exercise. Some will double their body weight beforehand by gorging on berries, insects, or mollusks. Others pump up the size of their flight muscles, increase their metabolism, and even grow or shrink their digestive organs to pack on or shed weight. In a study of gray catbirds, for example, University of Rhode Island physiologist and ecologist Kristen DeMoranville found the birds' flight muscles were larger during fall migration than in summer. And while the birds wintered and rested in the tropics, their hearts shrank in size and they gained fat, perhaps anticipating the next migration season. Scientists like DeMoranville are working to understand what genes and proteins are responsible for these body-morphing abilities, using findings from human medical research as a starting point. The results could signal which foods are crucial for birds' journeys, which in turn could help conservationists identify and protect the most important sources for nutrition. Secondly, how do birds know when to migrate? Even captive migratory birds get restless in fall and spring when they'd normally embark. Varied cues help birds decide when to start their journeys, says University of South Carolina ornithologist Nathan Senner, including day length, temperature, rainfall, food availability, and body condition. Birds may also pay attention to others, using social cues to decide when it's time to leave. How birds are using this information and how much they can change their behavior based on what they're sensing is less clear, says Senner. Researchers are also curious about how juvenile birds work out their migratory schedule when they've never made the journey before. Studies of the European nightjar show how a bird's migratory timing can be finely tuned to its fueling needs. Susan Akeson, an evolutionary ecologist at Lund University in Sweden, and her colleagues found that nocturnal nightjars hunt more actively on bright, moonlit nights and are also more likely to start migrating after a full moon than a new moon. After gorging for days, as if at a brightly lit buffet, they're fueled up and ready to take off. How do birds sleep on long migratory flights? Some birds take breaks during trips to rest and refuel. Others fly for days, crossing lakes, oceans, mountains, and continents without stopping. Scientists know it's possible for birds to sleep while flying, but don't know how much sleep different migrating species are actually catching on the wing. Proof birds can catch in-flight Zs coming from tracking great frigate birds, seabirds that can forage over the open ocean for weeks without landing. The frigate birds would typically rest half their brain at a time, with one eye closed, while gliding upward on spiraling air currents. Just because birds can sleep while flying doesn't mean they do. We have good reason to think some birds might just not sleep at all during night, says Niels Rattenborg, an avian sleep researcher at the Max Planck Institute for Ornithology. For one, there is no proof birds can sleep while actively flapping their wings. The ocean-going frigate birds slept only about 45 minutes a night, compared to more than a total of 12 hours a day back on land. And none of that was while flapping. Thank you for joining us for the April 20, 2022 reading of the Environment Program. I'm Karen Wheeler.